This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this. You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
Going to jump into the Red Square Rising Revolution Against Austerity. Oh, it's a coming. Better believe it's coming, and we see it coming day after day. Last week, thousands and tens of thousands on the street every night. The week before, over 400,000 on the streets. We reported on it here on AWOL Radio. Well, the night march magic. Quebec's People's Movement takes over the streets. It is well past midnight, and I have been marching nonstop for the past 4 hours. There are literally tens of thousands of people marching throughout Montreal tonight. This is from Roger Rashi, rabble.ca. The march I participated in started in one neighborhood in Montreal, the Plateau, with a couple of dozen people at the corner of Montréal and Delormier, at 8 p.m. Within half an hour, we were 1,000 strong as people came out streaming from their homes, from restaurant terraces and coffee shops, banging on pots and pans. As we marched through the neighborhood, we merged with other groups coming from the north, south, east, and west. By 9 p.m., we were several thousand. By 10 p.m., we were more than 10,000 and marching towards the neighborhoods to the north, Rosemount, Villeray, and Park Extension. By 11 p.m., the march was over 3 kilometers long, with an estimated 20 to 30,000 people chanting slogans and joyously banging on their pots and pans. As this was only one of several spontaneous marches going on throughout the city, the cops were practically invisible. How could they cope with thousands of people streaming simultaneously from 6 to 10 different neighborhoods in the city, with no fixed route and no discernible organization or leadership? Throughout the day, calls were put out on Facebook and over the internet, with literally dozens of meeting spots given in 10 different neighborhoods. These marches are totally illegal, openly flaunting the repressive Bill 78, making a mockery of Premier Charest's attempts to crush the student and people's movement. It is a direct answer to the incredible number of mass arrests. Close to 700 people were arrested during Wednesday night marches alone. These arrests have been replete with many acts of police brutality. Stupidly, the government thought this massive act of repression would cow the people. Barely 24 hours after Tuesday night's giant demo, when more than 250,000 people marched in the streets of Montreal. Instead, this last gambit has exploded in the government's face, galvanizing hundreds of thousands of people and turning the struggle into a giant people's movement, the likes of which I have not seen in over 40 years of political activism in Quebec. The people have taken over the streets in the city in a massive act of civil disobedience. Furthermore, the movement of civil disobedience has spread to the rest of the province, with demonstration marches and pots being banged in many towns and cities across Quebec. This incredible movement, sparked by the student strike against increased tuition fees, has morphed into a powerful mass movement against austerity measures and repressive policies. Far from petering out, it is gathering strength and has thrown the provincial government in total disarray. A full-fledged political crisis is looming. Keep your eyes on Quebec. There is more to come. Again, Roger Rashi, rabble.ca. Following up with that, a note from Quebec for friends elsewhere, watching the Maple Spring in Montreal. Note, Maple Spring is a play on words. Printemps Arabe sounds like Printemps Arabe, or Arab Spring. So it looks like the rest of the world is starting to notice what's happening here in Montreal. As what began as student protest just over 3 months ago against a hike in tuition fees snowballs into what is being described by media as a general social crisis, but is actually a genuine, powerful, and inspiring social uprising like I've never seen up close before. For about a month now, I've been mentioning casually to friends outside Quebec that things are boiling and becoming revolutionary. In this unusual corner of North America, well, as the last few nights, I'd say there are now in full boil, or maybe even boiling over. I just came back from one of the many, indeed many, many, neighborhood manif casseroles occurring all over the city tonight. At 8 p.m., people step out onto their balconies and onto the street banging pots and pans, gather on street corners and take over intersections, and then, leaderlessly, organically. The mass random groups of neighbors banging pots take to the streets and start heading off in one direction, gathering people as they go, joined en route and encouraged by bystanders on balconies. Cooks and restaurant staff stepping out of street cafes, all joyfully banging away on their own pots and pans and lids and coffee pots. What is astonishing is how mixed the crowd is. A lot of families, kids, older Quebecois, folks on bicycles and scooters, wheelchairs, and yes, of course, younger students. Everyone wearing the carré rouge, or the red felt square that has become the symbol of this strike. As we cling, clang, bang, tap, clanged our way through the local residential streets this evening, it was pretty astonishing to see how many people stepped out on their porches or hung out their windows with their own pots, banging. Hasidic families, wealthy French families, pensioners, North African families. We were a manifestation of about 300 people, I would guess, all spontaneously brought together, and there were several more roaming in the same neighborhood, and then probably tens or hundreds all over the city. Those separate roving protests have now all coalesced. A little while ago, an hour or two ago, we watched several thousand people joyfully banging and clanging their way past the end of our street, interestingly, headed not for downtown but deeper into the suburbs and neighborhoods. The Manif casseroles are directly bringing the neighborhoods into this struggle, rather than continuing what was becoming ritualized nightly confrontations between so-called students and police in the downtown core. The police are following, and right now in the air is thick with police helicopters. Last night, the casserole protests ended with over 500 arrests when a group were kettled at an intersection. Apparently, at the start of the night, it was leaked that the police had ordered to conduct a mass arrest as a show of force. Tonight, the demonstrations are way, way larger, and who knows what the police have in store. Only a week ago, this movement could have gone an entirely different way. The student protests were getting very little public sympathy, despite thousands marching every night. Their basic demands was to reverse an 80% hike in tuition that the provincial government is trying to impose. As the government and confused onlookers from the rest of Canada kept pointing out, Quebec has the lowest college and university tuition fees in North America, and the proposed hike would still leave Quebec as having the lowest tuition fees, so the students were painted as whining, entitled, and not facing up to the realities of the world, and that framing had some traction with ordinary working-class Quebecers too. Of course, the issue was never really just about tuition fees. As such, it was about debt and the corrupt neoliberal government increasing that debt while simultaneously handing out tax breaks to corporations, building contracts to the mafia and generous monies for the forestry and mining companies to industrialize the far north of the country, known as the Plan Nord. That there was more at play than just student fees became obvious in late April when the usually tame Earth Day rally here in Montreal attracted 300,000 people, many of them wearing the red squares. Quebec was pissed and the general anger was in the air. It was also about that government going back on a promise. The reason that Quebec has the lowest tuition fees is because this province underwent a huge, quiet revolution in the 60s and 70s, or a radical movement throughout the Catholic Church and an English-speaking elite, and embarked on a massive program and introduced European-style social welfare programs to lift a poor and undereducated population out of poverty. Free education was one of the promises of that quiet revolution, and although it wasn't quite achieved, the reformers promised that they would continue to work towards free education as an ideal. When successive governments tried to break that promise and increase tuition fees, students fought back and every time won, maintaining a freeze on tuition. Within the last decade, even this government was already forced to back down on this once before. Probably the most insightful comment I have heard on why the student protests have arisen here in Quebec and not elsewhere in Canada is as an Anglo-Montrealer on English radio who pointed out that the rest of Canada, ROC, tends to take USA as its comparison point, whereas Quebec takes France and Europe as its comparison point. To the ROC, it is inconceivable to imagine free university education since no one in North America has ever experienced such a thing, and it sounds like a pie-in-the-sky demand. To those of us with roots in old Europe, however, free education tuition is what we grew up with. It's normal, and it is a right. To Quebecers, being told that they should accept the same level of student debt as the rest of North America and give up on their social ideals is like an organic farmer being told they should shut up and accept the same level of pesticide contamination as industrial farmers. This is not the rest of North America. Quebec is a distinct culture, and it has principles, and they matter to Quebecers a lot. In effect, what I see as really at play in these protests, and there's a lot at play in many interpretations and explanations of the general rage in the air, is a people standing up and defending the social welfare model that makes their society distinct and special. Many people in this province are actually proud to pay the highest taxes in North America because they can also point to the strong social assistance programs, a thriving, educated, and cultured population, excellent arts and culture programs, world-leading filmmakers and musicians, long government-supported parental leave, excellent collective insurance policy covered by the state, a good working healthcare system, $7 a day daycare for all kids, and much more. In many ways, Quebec is France, or Denmark, or Sweden, and against all odds, it maintains this progressive, even mildly socialist political culture surrounded by two of the world's most rampant, neoliberal, anti-welfare corporate economies, USA and Canada. Taking apart the low tuition fees is rightly seen as the first move in a much larger austerity package to take apart all of the social welfare programs and replace them with what? More debt being collected by the same banks who just reaped billions of free government dollars from the financial bailout? Fired by both the Occupy movement and the protests against austerity and cuts in Europe, the students have strongly made the connection to the financial crisis, how they and all who come after them are being asked to finance the mistakes of a government still in the thrall to big business. I have to say, I think they are right. There is a great article by Michael Rosen, a UK writer of children's poems, who points out that the great welfare states of Europe, and this is true for Quebec, were built in a post-war economy shattered by real war, poverty, and hardship out of a belief in helping our fellow citizens and all pulling together. Yet now we are being told that wealthy countries who haven't experienced war or general poverty for some time and who recently found money to bail out banks and major corporations to the tune of several $1 trillion, over $100 billion here in Canada, just don't have the finances to maintain those same social welfare programs, even though those same programs were considered feasible back when we were poor and the economy was truly broken. For anyone with an inkling of history, that argument doesn't wash. What is going on is a larger ideological project to take apart the welfare state using the shock of the financial meltdown as an excuse. And that is the undercurrent to the three-month fight on the streets. Last Friday, however, that fight changed. The provincial government brought in an emergency special law called Law 78, or Loi 78, that has been described as a truncheon law, basically a package of draconian measures rushed through to make the protests illegal and impose harsh fines, especially on student leaders. Law 78 included ridiculous provisions, which meant you could be fined for inciting a protest on Twitter, for wearing a red square, or if more than 50 people meet up in a public space without giving police 8 hours advance warning and a route map. It was an attempt to smash the student protests through brute force, and far from intimidate and quell the protests, it poured gasoline on the flames. Actually, it kind of poured ammonium nitrate on them. The result has been explosive. Basically, Quebec people, at least Montrealers, have come out en bloc against the repressive law. Immediate critics included the Quebec Bar, the unions, leading legal professors, and the Quebec Human Rights Commission, and much more. It was perceived as a direct and disproportionate attack on civil liberties, particularly the right to assemble and the right to protest and free expression. Quite how Quebec Prime Minister Jean Charest could have been so badly misjudged how that law would light a touch paper in Quebec is beyond me. Quebecers care about human rights, civil liberties, and particularly their right to get together and express themselves. The few days after the bill was rushed through Parliament, the nightly protests swelled. The city sent in riot cops, and images of riots and fires in downtown filled newspapers along with 300 arrests. Then a large student demonstration, already scheduled for a Tuesday afternoon, a work day, turned into a red sea of hundreds of thousands of people marching, dancing, chanting through the streets of Montreal against Law 78, technically the largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history. That night, the Manif casseroles began. The next night, they swelled. Tonight, they exploded. They are popular civil disobedience par excellence. There are no information given to police ahead of time for the route. In fact, there is no route. The neighborhoods are alive with the ringing of pots and pans. In my neighborhood, at least red squares are pinned everywhere and on almost everyone. And this is Montreal, a city that likes to party, a city that likes to be outside. a city that's proud of its traditions of social activism, and a city that at the beginning of a long, hot summer. Right now, it's hard to see how this movement can go anywhere but bigger and louder with the cling, clang, bang of thousands of people defiantly banging pots ringing into the night for weeks to come. And that piece, found on aimfos.ca, Canada, a note from Quebec for friends elsewhere, watching the Maple Spring in Montreal. Going to another song and coming back with more of this Red Square Rising, the revolution against austerity. Worldwide, AWOL Radio. That was Angelic Upstarts with Anti-Nazi. It's against Nazis. Talking about elsewhere and this Red Square Rising, we got supporters bang pots and pans in solidarity with Quebec students A loud protest made its way through downtown Kitchener Wednesday night in a show of support for Quebec students. Dubbed Casseroles Night, similar demonstrations were slated to take place in communities across Canada and around the world. As a group of more than 100 banged on pots and pans in front of Kitchener City Hall, participant Sean Haberlin said the event sends a message to Quebec's post-secondary students, many of whom have been on strike for more than 100 days in the face of planned tuition hikes, that they're not alone. It's not just you in Quebec. There are other Canadians who support you, Haberlin said. From City Hall, the group unexpectedly took to the streets, marching down the middle of King Street as police officers scrambled to control traffic and curious onlookers watched from the sidelines. It's very encouraging, said Marie Ouellette, a visiting doctoral student from the University of Montreal. To see support from the rest of Canada is so rare and so beautiful. Although a few people in the crowd covered their faces with bandanas as police accompanied the group, the family-friendly protests retained a carnival-like atmosphere, as it usually does when people wear masks. Most wore red squares pinned to their clothes, a symbol adopted by the Quebec student movement. The group ended up on the steps of Kitchener Market, where a handful of speakers talked about the situation in Quebec and spoke of the financial realities facing students across Canada. In Ontario, our tuition is so much higher, said Janice Lee. We need to tell our politicians this is not acceptable. The heavy burden of student debt becomes the real issue. The Casseroles Night's events were not led by any formal group, but individuals with an interest in the Quebec movement. So yeah, 100 on the street, and another demonstration is expected to take place at 7 p.m. on Saturday at Kitchener City Hall. There's a very large demographic of people tapping into this. Casseroles, bring your pots and pans. Wear the red patch. The red square. Solidarity with Quebec. And from Toronto, pots and pans, Toronto solidarity with Quebec protests. There's a video on YouTube you can check out. It's on Operation Maple's channel, but it's also just a pretty good tune. And an open letter to the Canadian Federation of Students. Support Quebec students by bringing the movement to Ontario. To our representative students at the Canadian Federation of Students and affiliated student union locals, we, the undersigned, are writing to the CFS as proud students and unionists and activists, as well as workers and community members who support the student movement in Canada. We write this letter asking that the CFS engage in consistent and serious mobilizing effort to bring the Quebec student movement to the rest of Canada. We believe that this is the best solidarity we can give our sisters and brothers in Quebec. We believe it is the obligation of the elected student leaders to build this movement, and we commit as the rank and file students to support you. After 12 weeks of strikes against massive tuition hikes and facing massive police repression and brutality, the student movement in Quebec is forcing the government to budge. This is a heroic example. We ask that the CFS begin mobilizing for a student strike in Ontario and the rest of Canada. A campaign of mass educational, solidarity delegations, and mass mobilization should be used to lead up towards a student strike in Ontario. Bring the lessons of Quebec to Ontario. Quebec has shown again and again that the only way to force concessions from governments is to mobilize on a mass basis through a strike campaign and confront the government, not with postcards, but with action. Students and youth, as well as working population in general, have been inspired by the Quebec movement. We are therefore asking that our representatives at the CFS and affiliated locals immediately begin a campaign for free post-secondary education and make preparations to carry out a strike ballot in the fall of 2012. A massive student movement in Ontario would show the Quebec students they are not alone. It would strengthen the movement for free post-secondary education across Canada, and it would cut across the divisions created by the pro-business politicians and corporate press to weaken the student movement. Our response to the race to the bottom: tuition fees across Canada should be immediately lowered to the levels in Quebec, as a step towards abolishing all tuition fees in the country. prepared for an Ontario-wide strike vote in the fall of 2012.
Training in Quebec began as a student struggle, and it very much the heart of it is still a student struggle, obviously, but it's also, there's a lot of other austerity measures that Charest is trying to push down on the people in Quebec, and I think it's what it's become now is this incredible resistance to those cutbacks and to austerity, and people saying, you know, refusing to pay for what is a banker's crisis, and that incredible uprising that's happening there. If that is a spark for other locations in Canada, that is amazing and beautiful, and I think we should run with that.
That was Lisa Schofield from OCAP. And following up with that is two Quebec student unions join in a call for student strikes in the rest of Canada. Posted on the Toronto Media Co-op, we have received word that two student unions in Quebec have passed resolutions in support of open letters to the Canadian Federation of Students, which calls for the mobilization of a student strike in the rest of Canada. The following is an English translation of the resolution passed by the Political Science and Law Association at UQAM and by the Philosophy Students Association at the Université de Montréal. The original French translation is also on this Toronto Media Co-op page. Quote, whereas the student struggle in Quebec is taking place in an overall perspective of the rejection of the commodification and corporatization of education, considering the level of debt and high tuition fees in Canada, recognizing our responsibility of solidarity with the students in Canada and around the world, that this union endorse and sign the petition initiated by student activists in Ontario to push their student associations, the CFS, to start mobilization campaign that would lead to a strike vote in the fall. As well, the Law Association at UQAM and Political Science Association added the following to the resolution. Make members of this association individually sign the open letter and encourage the Social Action Committee of La Classe to spread the strike movement to North American universities. And it continues, and it continues. And a piece from Jesse Rosenfeld on how Occupy and Indignados helped inspire Quebec and where every street is Wall Street. With one of the best pictures or images I've seen, it's I, Carré Rouge, MTL. Sitting in the living room of a friend's Mile End apartment just shy of 8 p.m. on Thursday, this was posted May 29th, I'm called into the street by the deafening sound of clanging pots and pans. On the residential street lined with Montreal's classic triplex townhouses, people of all ages are gathering with their cookware. Children clang at the doorstep of their friends, calling them out. The now nightly casseroles are the latest form of popular outrage to Premier Jean Charest's new special laws that curb freedom of assembly and association rights, in a bid to break 3 months of social unrest. As I wander around the block, I hear parents, children, students, and seniors chant in a sing-song voice, "We don't give a damn, clang, 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 about the special law." And if you're against the hike, clang, clang, clang. Then spontaneously, the crowd starts marching. What was dozens quickly turns to hundreds as neighbor come down from their balconies. I unexpectedly bump into one of my old McGill profs. She taught me philosophy of existentialism. I just live around the corner from here and didn't expect this. It's just amazing, says the woman who taught me about the theorists behind Paris's 1968 revolt. As I look at my Twitter feed, I realize these protests are happening throughout the city. Later in the evening, among a crowd of thousands banging pots and pans in the city's north end, Jean Talon Market, I notice police have tweeted there are many protests in Montreal and we can only follow two. The outpouring, at one point after several large marches intersect, it seems to reach around 10,000, is a direct response to the kettling and mass arrest of over 500 on Wednesday during the downtown protests. Students credit the idea of the nightly marches to the ones that brought down the East German Soviet state in 1989. That crackdown carried eerie similarities to the G20 crackdown on the protests in front of the Novotel Hotel in Toronto, with riot police cordoning off a sizable chunk of the protests for mass arrest. Still, I run into many of those who were released in the earlier hours of Thursday morning back on the streets tonight. Awestruck by this unplanned mass response, I remember what CLASS, the largest association of striking students, spokesperson Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois told me earlier. Quote, "This is primarily a movement of refusal," he said. Students, he reminded me, are using examples set by Spain's Indignados and Occupy Wall Street to shape the expanding struggle. Every street is Wall Street. Amir Kadir, leader of the young left-wing party Quebec Solidaire, tells me, walking his bike amongst the thousands just after 11:30 p.m., as I pass him a lighter for a cigarette. The lone member of the National Assembly for his party, he tells me that the Quebec unrest is a popular uprising, not only about tuition now, but about equality and social justice. Leaning on his bike as he walks with camera flashes all around, he describes the movement as demanding to take back power from a corrupted and unrepresentative political elite. When I point out to him that many students don't want an election because they don't see any tangible promise coming from the electoral politics, he smiles. That's why we are a party that fights both in the streets and in the National Assembly. This movement may be drawing on global influences, Paris 1968, the Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, European anti-austerity movements, etc., but it is fundamentally Quebecois. Its talent has been to pool tactics and inspiration from elsewhere to create a crisis around inequality at home. Jesse Rosenfeld is a Toronto-based journalist. And again, how Occupy and the Indignados helped inspire Quebec, where every street is Wall Street. And how the Indignados do it? That's a decent question. And one piece in elpas.com. Or elpais.com, I suppose that is, the English section. The 15M publishing explosion. In its 12 months of existence, the protest movement has not only spawned its own literary phenomenon, but also boosted sales of essays and classics. It's through propaganda, people. Quote, "We were in a cultural dictatorship, and now we are smack in the middle of a cultural revolution," claims Guillaume Martinez, a journalist as well as the author and coordinator of CT, O la cultura de la transition, or CT, or the culture of transition. It is the latest book spawned by the 15M protest movement, that's 15 May, and joins around 20 others that have also jumped on the bandwagon, enough to warrant their own specific table in a major bookstore such as L'Ai in Barcelona. It took the Spanish publishing industry little more than a month to respond to the 15M phenomenon. By June 2011, Las Voces del 15M, or The Voices of the 15M, was the first book to go on the shelves. Quote, "and one of the ones that got the most word-of-mouth recommendations," says Martinez. Just 3 months later, the protest movement against the political class and its mishandling of the economic crisis has reached comic book format, with such titles as Revolution Complex and Yes, We Camp. Then the trend appeared to peter out somewhat. Quote, "things calmed down, and now I'm surprised that there is no stock-taking being done for the first anniversary," notes Louis Moral of L'Ai. Quote, "there can't be any stock-taking because there isn't a movement. It is barely forming now, as shown by the more specific debates going on regarding issues such as deed in lieu of foreclosure," explains Anna Monojo of Icaria, perhaps the publishing house that has invested the most in the topic. "Until now, we publishers have picked up on the reasons for indignation and on the other demonstrations of the people's state of mind. Now we are hinting at possible alternatives. The movement is still at work in the progress." Icaria released its first two titles, most in real time with the street protests. They were short, accessible texts that brought up concerns that were perhaps still latent then, but later came to the fore, as shown by such titles as "Quiénes son los mercados y cómo no gobernan," or "Who are the markets and how are we ruled by them?" and "Vivir en deudocracia," or "Living in deptocracy." That's why I haven't seen that word in English or Spanish before. The latest upcoming release in the collection is Public Banking, or Banca Pública, to be followed by two other titles. And what we're seeing here is that it is the people that are putting out texts. It's the publishers that are really pushing these movements. You know, publishers at any level. Small independent publishers working from, you know, your, I wouldn't suggest a jet printer. I'd suggest maybe a laser jet, not an inkjet. And you can get a lot of propaganda out there and get it into people's hands. What I've heard again and again, and what this author from El País is saying, is that, you know, it's that the proliferation of the information helps with the proliferation of the movement. So we need to be publishing information that we want people to read and getting it into their hands. It's simple, it's effective, and it's well known. And it's what we've heard in report back after report back from Spain, and how and how specific groups have been able to put and get their beliefs or their economic ideologies, their social, cultural, organizational ideologies out there is through propaganda. It's about publishing your thoughts in media, in where you can. Publish it on the blogs, get it out in paper format, put it out on the radio. Red Square Rising, big problems coming for neoliberalism. We're going to a tune. This is AWOL Radio here on 100.3. Song's going to be from the Distillers. I am Revenant.
Another year has passed and I'm alright. A liquor's over my wounds and running through the night. Running through the night.
And as we move forward in this social movement that is hopefully sweeping into Ontario, as we start to rise up en masse against neoliberal capitalism, against continuing colonial genocide, we need to deal with our shit. The importance of dealing with Occupy's misogyny problem. Sasha Wiley, May 9th, 2012, posted on rabble.ca. Back in the days of our encampment, I remember reading and hearing discussion about Occupy's asshole problem. I remember my mother, after one of many general assemblies she attended, talking about the libertarian derailers intent on hijacking who tried to block any collective action unless it fit within their narrow pro-pot agenda. which is not actually an agenda I oppose. Mine's just longer and broader, such as, how can we get a government system that will be reflective of the will of people on issues like pot? But I digress. I remember meeting after meeting where the people who talked the loudest and most proceeded to complain about being unheard, when all that had really transpired was people not agreeing with them. Freedom of thought and the right to have people agree with you are irreconcilable, so the right to be heard necessarily has to stop there, as the right to speak one's mind. With hindsight, to put the pieces together, a bigger picture emerges. I remember who in particularly these people were. Male, predominantly white, alienated and resultantly defensive, and at their absolute worst any time they were confronted by women. When I facilitated meetings, they pushed back. When we talked about making space for other voices, they screamed about being silenced. And they are still with us. Anyone hearing the stories of the May Day General Assembly or watching Occupy Vancouver Facebook discussions can't avoid seeing it. What we are really seeing is Occupy's misogyny problem. And it's one of the movement shares with, the rest of planet Earth. By and large, they are the boys I grew up with. Demographically speaking, that is. They are around my age, late 20s into 30s. Most of them have little in the way of formal education and speak proudly about rejecting such societal constructs, albeit underlaid with a high degree of insecurity. Most have struggled with economic marginalization, coming from that same place I grew up, looking at the poverty line. And they are angry. Few seem to be engaged in any sort of intellectually or emotionally fulfilling work, and instead experience physical exploitation and grueling labor positions. I grew up playing video games and late-night D&D with them. I empathize with them in a lot of ways. They come from a generation of men experiencing social displacement, connected to changing gender roles, a transition that is absolutely imperative, but nonetheless left these men without accessible mentors or models, as they were told not to follow in the footsteps of their fathers, and a great many grew up without fathers to help them navigate this shift. Taken together, the result of all this intense feeling of alienation, and like everyone in our society, they grew up with patriarchy. Patriarchy is historically rooted in male ownership of, and thus entitlement to, female bodies. Media gives us no shortage of examples of this. Be a man type statements are underwritten with the notion that accessing women at will for sexual and other kinds of personal gratification is the basis of socially acceptable masculinity, providing yet another source for feelings of exclusion and rejection these men carry. Due in large part to the social and economic factors I've identified, and exacerbated by their personal anger and defensiveness tendencies to reject before they are again rejected, in my experience, these men do not tend to have many close women in their lives and express not having the level of sexual success they desire, unwittingly parroting the patriarchal construct about access to women. They aren't getting what their society tells them they are entitled to, and that's the last on a long list of grievances against a world they don't feel wants them anyways. But this time, it's a grievance with a clear culprit. Nothing so nebulous as social systems or economic models. They blame the women by whom they feel rejected, and the result is this embodiment of misogyny. And in Occupy Vancouver, this problem has blown up. One of these men had an intimate encounter with a woman in the movement, after she had no desire to continue it, but he did. And we have seen all the ensuing confrontations. What's at stake is not establishing exactly what happened between these two, but rather our ability or inability to create a culture within our movement where women's boundaries are acknowledged and valued. No matter what exactly transpired between these individuals, one thing is clear from the proliferate collection of written communication between them that the male party publicized in a misguided attempt to defend his actions. He felt entitled to continued sexual contact with her despite her expressed boundary. What's more, and in equal parts telling and worrying, is that his reaction to being denied continued sexual contact was to claim that he was being abused and oppressed, an idea deeply rooted that patriarchal presumption that men's right to women's bodies. In an attempt to address this situation and diffuse the mounting anger on both sides, I spent many hours in conversation with this man and some of his friends. I heard stories and stances that echo so many I have heard from my male acquaintances in the same demographic subset. women who were users because they got what they wanted and they didn't give him what he wanted. That is, he freely consented to a request from her and carried the expectation that he was then entitled to a similar consent from her. I hear analogies like, imagine you lent a friend money and that they refused to do the same for you when you were in need. With no awareness of the extent to which such analogies reinforce the notion of women as property, an asset, with seemingly no understanding of why it might be problematic to assume that because one person at some point wants something, another person also wants, that they also want whatever else that person wants. When a person consents, it is specific to a moment, a situation. When a woman consents, she is not consenting to a man's right to her, but to a shared desire, in a specific context and at a particular point in time. The latter necessarily does not imply the former. Talking about the social programming that women have to overcome in order to assert boundaries with men, and the resultant necessity that men listen to and don't try to push past boundaries that women do assert, I was met with stories such as a time when one of them had a sexual encounter with a woman and wanted to go again even though she said she didn't. He proceeded to pressure her into changing her mind. Although I admit I avoided asking about the outcome of that particular chain of events. Time and time again, I was met with that, but it wasn't that bad, was it? Challenge? That's the same sense of entitlement. I don't think these men are inherently bad people at all, but I do find it necessary to challenge their misogyny, rooted as it is in what amounts to a cycle of oppression. The transference of the hatred and contempt they feel the world has for them onto the hatred of women around them. They blame women for their feelings of alienation because when we can blame someone who has even less power than we do, it is easy to enact our anger without social reprisal. These men cite the Constitution and state that they must be proven guilty, denying the power imbalances upon which these situations are built. In the court system, an accused person has the right to the presumption of innocence because they are in a situation where they face accusation from a system that is more powerful than they are. The weight of a Crown prosecutor and law enforcement is brought to bear on them, and what at stake is their liberty, in the most basic sense of the term, personal freedom to live outside of the confines of jail. When a woman seeks support in a situation of harassment or violence, the power situation is reversed. The accusation comes from the party with the least power. When the power balance is reversed, so too must be the burden of proof. To presume innocence not only defies statistical and established truth about such allegations, but in essence extends the oppression of women, assuming once again that the man knows best, even when the issue is the woman's body. It's a red herring at best. The issue is woman's safety, not men's honor or reputation. Frankly, when we get to a point that all women have to fight to defend is such an intangible because their physical integrity is no longer under threat, we'll be living in a much more equal world than we are today. Until such a time as that, we have to continue to be bold enough to take collective action in defense of our sisters. A revolution that does not seek to address systematic patriarchy is not a revolution but another manifestation of the status quo. These men do not need our condemnation. They face no shortage of that from the world at large, but they do need us to continue to assert clear boundaries and enforce them when necessary. The challenges these men face will not be resolved through conflict with the women around them, but through challenging the social structures that do contribute to their lived experience of alienation. And that means taking away the safe and comfortable scapegoat of blaming women, so we engage in the struggle, not with each other, but with the system in need of transformation. Doing so is essential in both their liberation and ours. Sasha Wiley is an adult ed teacher and union activist and a part-time slam poet. She was a BC Teacher Federation Status of Women rep for 3 years and co-chair for one of their committees for action on social justice. And again, that's the importance of dealing with Occupy's misogyny problem. We're going to another tune. This one is from Red Union with The Partisan.
When they board across the border,
Back to AWOL Radio here, 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS, Waterloo, Ontario. Glad you can join us, soundfm.ca, peaceculture.org, rabble.ca, podcast network. We got one final piece for you before kicking to a few interviews that we've done over the last few weeks. They're awesome.